all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
And good afternoon, everybody out there listening to Veterans Radio. It's a gorgeous fall day here in the Ann Arbor, Michigan area, and we hope you're enjoying your weekend as well. We have a great show today. We're going to talk about civil affairs, one of the Army's hottest jobs, according to the Army Times. We have a master sergeant and a major joining us who have experience with civil affairs and a very interesting careers as well to talk about. So we look forward to getting that here after getting through some preliminary announcements, as we always do at the top of the hour. Want to let you know about an upcoming event, Salute to Veterans Gala by the Michigan Paralyzed Veterans of America here in the Metro Detroit area on Friday, November 14th at 6 o'clock. If you're interested in participating in that event, you can call Jacqueline Coaches, who's the Deputy Director of the Michigan PVA, at 248-476-9000, extension 06. Before I move on to a couple of others, I forgot to mention that unknown voice in the room. Dale Thornberry sitting in with me at the start here. He moved away a little out of my eyesight, and it's
Well, they've got this studio set up like it's a movie theater or something. I'm not sure exactly what's going on, but I just wanted to is that the annual dinner for the PVA?
It is. Yes.
And where is it going to be this year?
And it's going to be this year at the Suburban Showcase, I believe.
Oh.
A very nice affair. Master of Ceremonies is Rich Luderman, and this year's keynote speaker is Nicholas Kulcher, who's the DAV National Services Officer, a U.S. Army veteran.
I think that's the dinner where I first met you.
Oh, could well have been.
Gary and I came down to Detroit somewhere and went to that meeting, and then the following year, I think they had me as the host, and Governor Granholm at the time was the guest speaker.
Yeah, this has been, don't recall how many years they're at this, but it's been probably 6 or 8 years now at this point, and we always try to support it. It's a great event, and what PVA does is wonderful work for our veterans who are primarily wheelchair bound.
Right, absolutely. So this is one you guys got to put on your schedule. You said in November 14th, 6 o'clock?
It is, yes.
And to give them a call at 248-476-9000.
You got it.
I got it. See?
Very good.
I'm going to have to save up my pennies to go to that one.
We have another one up that we've actually had on the show talking about the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency from the state of Michigan. They have their Detroit program on November 7th and 8th. It's a hiring program. Hiring Our Heroes job fairs is November 8th, but on the 7th there's all kinds of vendors and programs directed to veterans regarding education, healthcare, benefits, and more. That's at Cobo Center, and you can get more information on that at www.michiganveterans.com or 1-800-642-4838. So we wanted to pass that along. We had the director of outreach on earlier this summer, and he wanted to make sure that we were promoting their event that has already occurred in Grand Rapids. This is the only Metro Detroit area program in Detroit on November 7th and 8th, and then they go up to the UP and do one there as well.
Okay. Well, you know, just a reminder to our audience out there, Jim, is to, if you do have events or anything that is coming up, to let us know. And you can send an email either to Jim, Bob, or Dale at Veterans Radio, and we'll make sure we get you on the air or at least announce the event. And if we can become more technically savvy, we'll even put it on our website. And so, yeah, make sure that you let us know about these things, especially with Veterans Day coming up. I know there's going to be a lot of events. I just got an email from a big event out in California that we'll talk more about probably next week. But we'd love to promote whatever you're doing to help veterans. This is what we're here for.
And why don't we talk a little bit about next week, Dale? You have a very interesting program for next week's show as well.
Well, we've got two things going on next week. Another, talking about looking for jobs for veterans, is that the Department of the Army is actually going to have a representative on the program, and they're looking for medical, I don't know if they're medical assistants, nurses, anything else that has to do with the medical field, but they are recruiting, and they are looking for civilian contractors to for these jobs, and also, of course, they want people with experience in the background. So some of you medics out there that might have already gotten out of the service, this may be a program for you to listen to. That would be on the first part of the program. And then in the second half of the program, we're going to be talking with a gentleman who's written a book called Conversation with Major Dick Winters. Now, I don't think anybody out there probably knows who Dick Winters is, but he was the commander of Easy Company, and Easy Company was the basis of the TV program Band of Brothers, 101st Airborne, hoorah, as Bob would say. And we've had a number of guests on the program who were part of Easy Company, and I'm anxious to talk to this author because it's a great story and talks more about leadership, again, what the military helps these people that are, you know, when they're finished with their military careers, they go on to bigger and better things. And the influence that their service, their military, their time in the military had on them are great stories. And so we're going to be talking about Major Dick Winters next week on Veterans Radio.
Well, that's great. Glad everybody can hear about that now and plan on tuning in next week.
Absolutely.
This is a little bit of reach back I thought we'd do. Back on June 22nd on Veterans Radio, we had on a couple of guests to talk about the plight of Amir Hekmati. Amir Hekmati is a former Marine and decorated war veteran. He was raised here in the Michigan area. After his time in service and before he was starting some advanced education at the University of Michigan, he decided to go back to Iran and visit his grandmother. And after spending about a few weeks there, he was grabbed up by the Iranian police and held as a CIA operative and ultimately convicted and sentenced to, I believe, 10 years in prison. There's been a campaign to free Amir Hekmati, and we had on his sister and Congressman Dale Kildee, who talked about the efforts that they were engaged in trying to keep this situation in the forefront. They certainly feel that Amir was grabbed up by the Iranians simply because he was a former Marine. And because of some things happening in the UN in the last week, there was an opportunity for increasing the publicity on this issue. And Amir actually got an opportunity to speak to his mother by phone. And his sister posted for him part of that conversation that I thought our folks might want to go and read. Obviously, he's talking about his all the support that he's been able to get and wants to thank all of us, including us at Veterans Radio, for the support that we've shown to his family and to the cause. So if you were interested in that story back in June and wondering if Amir Hekmati has been released, he has not. And if you want to follow along with what's going on and maybe read his most recent conversation that's been posted, go to www.freeamir.org, freeamir.org, and you can continue to watch what's happening to one of our fellow veterans. And as I say, I think we all worry a little bit about how we are perceived overseas, and certainly this is an instance where I think a veteran was perceived very poorly, and our government needs to do something with getting him released. So we wanted to bring that back to your attention before we move on to our topic for today, which is the Civil Affairs Division in the Army. And we'll come back to that right after this announcement from one of our sponsors.
Schoolcraft College is proud to have served the communities of Southeast Michigan for 5 decades. So it should come as no surprise that they're just as committed to serving those who have served our country. Schoolcraft College Veteran Services provides assistance to veterans using their educational benefits. They help with the VA benefits application process, provide academic advising, and plan programs of study according to VA guidelines. Classes are forming now in Livonia and Garden City. Visit schoolcraft.edu for more information.
Well, welcome back to Veterans Radio, and we're ready to get into today's specific topic on the Army's Civil Affairs Group, and we're really delighted to have two guests with us today. a Master Sergeant John Archer and Major Jeff Hoos. They come from different sets of experiences that we'll have them explain to us, and they have lengthy careers in the military. They've touched civil affairs in the reserve component and have done overseas assignments, and I think they'll help us shed a little light on what civil affairs is in today's Army. Let's start with John. Are you with us, and can you say hello to our Veterans Radio audience?
I'm here, sir. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing good. And where, John, where are you today?
Right now I'm in beautiful Killeen, Texas, right near Fort Hood.
Okay. Well, hopefully your weather's as beautiful as we've got up here in the Michigan area, which brings me to Major Jeff Hoos. Jeff, how are you doing today?
Good evening, Jim. Great to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you on. Both of you gentlemen have distinguished careers, and we'd like to get to know you a little bit better and talk about those careers. And ultimately, we'll be talking about civil affairs, which caught my eye when the Army Times described it as the hottest job in the Army at this point. And that sort of caught me by surprise. So I said, I got to talk to somebody about that. Master Sergeant, why don't we start with you? Why don't you start, John, and tell us a little bit about your military career give our listeners an understanding of the perspective that you bring to the table.
Okay, Jim. I enlisted back in 98 as an infantryman and did all the wonderful jobs that come along with that, right up from regular rifleman to team leader and on up through to platoon sergeant as my last duty assignment as an 11 Bravo, which is an infantryman. And did that for about 13 years and then switched over to the civil affairs side in the reserve here in 2011.
And during your time in the military, have you had any overseas assignments?
I have, as a matter of fact. Like many of my brothers and sisters in arms here, I've done three tours to Iraq and one to Afghanistan, and I'll be headed back over to that vicinity here in the next couple of weeks, as a matter of fact.
And I'll ask you a little bit more about that later, John. That's, again, thank you for your service. Major, why don't you give us the thumbnail sketch of your career at, which is, I think, 20-some years at this point. 26 years, I'm sorry.
I actually I came in at the end of the Marine era, so I'm what they call an SF baby. I came in the Army and went straight through one station training, airborne school, and straight off to the Special Forces Qualification Course. So I was a 12 Bravo or a combat engineer for a short period of time, became an SF NCO shortly thereafter in the reserve component, so I was an 18 Charlie. And I did that for about 8 years before I finally completed my degree and headed off to Officer Candidate School on active duty. I became an engineer officer. Fairly varied background on the engineer side of the house for military. And I was an engineer officer for about 4 years before I got off active duty and joined the reserve. I joined the 15th Civil Affairs and was in Michigan.
Jeff, we're having a little sound quality, I think, with your cell phone. If you can make sure it's you've got it right where it needs to be, and we'll see if we can keep a strong signal on it.
Okay, Jim, you got me now?
That's better.
Okay, great. So I joined CA Civil Affairs back in 2000 before there was a whole lot going on. And at that time, it was a really neat career field to be in because they had the opportunity to go overseas quite a bit, and it was more like vacation travel. I stuck with it through 9/11, and as a result, after 9/11, I went very personal with my unit, came home for a few weeks, and then turned right around and went to Iraq for a year. And then when I came back from Iraq, I actually resigned my commission as a senior captain and went back to Special Forces and did another tour in Iraq with SF as a SF, a senior engineer sergeant, 18 Charlie E7 at the time. And came back from that and figured out I'm getting kind of old for this and got my commission back and joined the Michigan National Guard. Held my civil affairs branch as well as my engineer branch and I actually picked up another branch as an MI officer and ended up doing about 15 months over in Afghanistan with a two-star command. So I've kind of bounced all over the place with the military for 26 years.
Yeah, I had the chance to look at Jeff's biographical summary of his military career, and bouncing all over the place is a good way to describe it. You've had a very interesting career, and we're going to get to talk about some of those different duty assignments. But let me go back to the Master Sergeant. Hey, John, why did you join up to begin with?
Well, it's a combination of things, obviously, and I think most of these traits exist in the people that have joined the military, so I'm not too different, but a long-standing tradition in my family on my father's side, that service in the Army, and then, I have that normal sense of duty and, wanted to serve the, country as best I could, and I felt it was duty to enlist, and, honestly, it's just been a kind of an innate thing inside that drove me to join the military, and I've enjoyed it since I've been in.
And one of the things I've noticed, John, I think this goes true for you too, Jeff, maybe you'd comment on it as well, is it certainly created an opportunity for you to get some further college education. Isn't that the way it's worked, John?
Absolutely. I am currently in school, and thanks to the GI Bill, the post 9/11 GI Bill, and It's amazing. It's an amazing opportunity to be given the chance to go to school for doing what I did, and I'm appreciative of it every day. And hopefully I'll end up here with a master's in time and go on to make some good use out of that.
I had the chance to ask John earlier, tell me where you're from. Where should I say you're from? He said, well, I think your response was a traditional Army brat. I've been everywhere.
That is the absolute truth. I have the most difficult time answering people when they ask me where am I from. So my usual response is, do you want to know where I was born, or would you like to pick a year and I can tell you where I lived or where I was physically located at the time?
Well, I chose not to pick Hawaii, which is, I think, where you were born, but instead went with New Jersey, where you seems you had the most contact. I don't know if that's right or not, but that's how we got there.
My mother will be appreciative, and most of my family, since they are from the New Jersey area. I went to school there for a little while and have some fantastic friends and family still there, so I think that's an appropriate choice.
I must admit I leaned a little bit that way because my co-pilot here, Dale Throneberry, is from New Jersey, so we gave him a Garden State shout-out on that as well. So, Jeff, I think you've also seen your... maybe answer both questions of why you joined up and has it created an opportunity for additional education for you?
Well, Jim, you've got a two-for-one here. I'm also an Army brat, traditional Army brat. So I did grow up all over the place, just like John. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if I was in Hawaii when he was born. I was there from 74 to 77 when my dad was stationed at Schofield Barracks. So, I moved around quite a bit until I was 8. My parents said that I had always wanted to join the Army from the time I could talk. And I think that's a direct result of being around the military all the time. My dad joined the reserves when I was 8 years old. He got on active duty. We moved back to Michigan. But still heavily involved with military service. My dad was involved heavily right up until he retired in 2000. So, you know, a real strong military family, strong military background, and that's pretty much what led me to military service.
And I think out of that you've had an opportunity, and I'm not sure I can follow it exactly when you were able to pick up your bachelor's in computer science.
I did. I also used GI Bill. I used the traditional Montgomery GI Bill. So, I've been very fortunate. I used the Montgomery GI Bill, and then after 9/11, Congress was nice enough to bring along with Department of Veterans Affairs, the post 9/11 GI Bill, and now I've got the opportunity to take an extra year that I can pass on to my children. So my kids will enjoy 12 months of education as a result of my service.
Well, I think that's one of the things our country's done right for its military members who are serving, and making sure that opportunity does pass is transferable to pass along to the kids. You've both mentioned 9/11 a little bit. Before we jump off to something else, I wanted to back up and ask you, John, what you did, what your reaction was, where they sent you as a result of 9/11, and I'll ask Jeff the same thing.
Sure. I was, as a matter of fact, I was on Fort Dix, which is in New Jersey, not far from the Twin Towers the morning of. We were training soldiers to go to Bosnia, as a matter of fact, and we got news of it that very day, and found myself in the city and in the airports not long after doing some security missions there. So it hit close to home, and very scary time, but, you know, ingrained in your memory, like I'm sure everyone else's, but I had the opportunity to help, I hope, secure the airport afterwards for quite a long while, the airport and the nuclear power plant in the area.
And, Jeff, what once 9/11 occurred, how did that change your service?
Boy, life-changing event. At that time, I was about a year and a half into my civilian career off active duty, and I was questioning whether or not to continue military service in the reserve component. Civilian side was going really well, and like I said, the reserve side, that civil affairs unit, that was a trip over to Germany once or twice a year. And I wasn't really sure, but after 9/11, it was literally that day I left work early. Told my boss, I've got to go, and I'll call you when I've got an update. I called my unit, which is literally 7 miles from my house, and just told them if you need anything at all, just send me a ring. And it was the next day they called, and they asked me to be the night battle captain or staff duty officer, basically. So I worked nights at my unit, 12-hour shifts, for about 3 weeks, and we figured out the unit wasn't going to go anywhere on the very first rotation to Afghanistan, so a lot of slots for different schools opened up on active duty side of the house, and they pushed me down to the reserve component. So my unit asked me if I was interested in going to Lander School, and that was a Monday morning, and I said, absolutely. I'll do whatever the military needs right now. And I asked them a couple simple questions. What language? And they said Russian. Where is it? Where do I have to go? And they told me Monterey, California. And then the last question, what am I going to be on? The piece gets moved to Bielsa for a year. When I came home and told my wife, hey, honey, we're moving to California for a year. And she looked at me with a blank stare and said, no, you're going to California. The kids are getting ready for school. We're going to be here until the end of the semester. So my family didn't join me until January. But I went straight to language school, and just like Fort Dix, the Presidio Monterey was just a changed place. What had been an open post and free-flowing turned into a closed post with, beers and beers all around and cars at every gate. And we went from there. And I just stayed on active duty for the next 3 years at school or deploying.
I think one of the things that it's easy for the general population maybe to forget events, historical events that move on, but they end up impacting the military lives for years and decades to come. And as we see things happen overseas, there's a lot of stuff almost always going on. We may continue on with our normal civilian life because we don't have to worry about it, but that's largely because there's men and women such as yourself out there protecting us and worrying about it so that we don't have to worry about it here. I know when 9/11 happened, my wife, who's now a retired brigadier general, Carol Ann, was in Washington, D.C. on her way to the Pentagon when that plane hit. As you all remember, communications went down, travel went down. It was a hard time for the families as well as the military members who And it did impact everybody's life. It obviously sent Jeff, you off to a whole new direction in schooling, and it reshaped what you were doing as well, John. Before we hit the bottom of the hour and pick up the news break, we want to mention that what we're going to do on the other side of the news is talk about civil affairs. The DOD identifies civil affairs operations to include coordinating military activities with other government, U.S. government departments and agencies, with civilian agencies of other governments, and host nation military and paramilitary elements and non-governmental organizations. It's a very interesting field. I think, Jeff, I think you referred to it at one point. It was just a nice way to get overseas a couple of times a year. It certainly has changed since then, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's an even better way to get overseas now.
you're guaranteed
at least one trip. So it takes somebody with a lot of, I don't even want to say serious interest. You know that you're going to be heavily involved as soon as you become a civil affairs member, and it's evolved unbelievably over the last 10 years. In fact, I'm really interested to hear what John has to say about current civil affairs.
Well, we'll be moving to that just shortly after we hit the bottom of the hour here, but I wanted to set it up for everybody to make sure that they stay tuned. We're all sort of aware of the Army kicking butt and taking names, but this is a whole other component of it, and it's a very much in-the-face component of what we do now in the military as part of our service. So we'll go to that further discussion.
This is the Blaze Radio News. I'm Dave Perkins.
The fact that we don't know of a breach in protocol is concerning because clearly there was a breach in protocol.
The director of the CDC, Dr. Tom Frieden, on the fact that a nurse in Dallas now testing positive for Ebola.
We have the ability to prevent the spread of Ebola by caring safely for patients.
Frieden, appearing on CBS Face the Nation, the nurse contracting the Ebola virus in spite of wearing full protective gear during all sessions of care with the Dallas Ebola patient.
This is part of how complicated it is.
Former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. John Bolton saying the Kurds might be at least partly to blame for their own problems.
Inside Turkey and throughout Europe, in fact, Kurds have been demonstrating against the Turks' indifference.
Kurds perhaps provoking the Turks into not helping. Bolton on Justice with Judge Jeanine on Fox News. A little too much excitement for air passengers lately in these United States. The Blaze Radio's Greg Moore reports.
Not one, but two U.S. Airways flights making emergency landings at Charlotte Douglas International Airport on Saturday. U.S. Airways Express Flight 5782, operated by Republic Airways, forced to make an emergency landing due to a hydraulic problem. Before that, a U.S. Air flight from New York's LaGuardia making an emergency landing after experiencing cabin pressure issues. There were no injuries reported in either incident.
And just when the Japanese thought it was safe to go outside, another big storm, the Blaze Radio's Chris Vermilion.
Typhoon bringing hard rain and heavy winds to the southern islands of Japan, the second severe storm to hit in a week. About 30 people reported injured, as 150,000 are ordered to evacuate. The typhoon is packing winds up to 110 miles per hour. It's being downgraded from a super typhoon as it continues to pelt other parts of Japan.
I'm Dave Perkins. This is news on the Blaze Radio Network. Truth lives here.
Living at American House is like being on a cruise ship, with all the lovely surroundings, the many, many activities, and the people to share with. It's so comfortable to be here. I feel safe. I don't have to shop. I don't have to cook. I don't have to clean up.
When you move into an American House senior living community, you open the door to a new world of possibilities. Our life enrichment directors are committed to enhancing the lives of residents every day. We look forward to finding out what interests you.
I just get dressed up and walk down to the dining room and enjoy my meals in the company of other people at my table.
For more moments made in American House, go to AmericanHouse.com. Again, that's AmericanHouse.com. Or watch us at YouTube.com/AmericanHouseLiving.
Living here has enriched my life. I'm Carol Huck, and I made in American House.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're glad to have you listening on WHAM 1600 Talk Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan. If you have questions for our guest, you can call in at 844-838-1600. We have with us Master Sergeant John Archer and Major Jeff Hoos, both who have distinguished military careers and are still on active duty and have had various roles in the area of civil affairs that we're going to talk about. The Army Times, back in, I think it was June, identified this as one of the top upcoming jobs in the Army and really talked about how the civil affairs troops are conducting peacetime operations both in those countries where we think about it being hot, if you will, Afghanistan or Iraq, but in more than 40 different countries, we have men and women in civil affairs, Army civil affairs, working with civilian agencies and organizations in what may be seen as a low-profile way, but sort of leveraging their power of developing relationships and friendships with folks to advance the interests of the U.S. military. In that setup, I also wanted to read one more little segment out of the Department of Defense Directive on Civil Affairs, which defines it as supporting stability operations, including activities that establish civil security, provide support to governance, provide essential services, support economic development and infrastructure, and establish civil control for civilian populations in occupied or liberated areas until such control can be returned to civilian or non-civilian U.S. military authority. Now, that's a pretty broad scope of requests that we place on our men and women. John, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your experiences in the civil affairs arena.
Sure. I, like most people in the military, in the Army especially, thought I knew what civil affairs was until I came in and realized it is a multitude of dynamic and multifaceted type jobs that we do. I mean, we can read from the book or whatever the PAO has sent, and I can tell you that the primary function that we do is to support a combatant commander in an environment by engaging the civil component that's the population that's there, and to assist the civil population by helping them get their government and their facilities, infrastructure, et cetera, back on their feet, while simultaneously helping the combatant commanders that we work for accomplish their mission. So it's a difficult MOS to describe, in that there's so many things you can get involved with. It's never ending. So it becomes a difficult thing to explain. And we have all these fancy terms for things that we do, but basically, we are there to help the nation that we are in get back on its feet, basically.
In the civilian leaders that you might be assisting, John, are these what we would refer to as governors or mayors or town council people? How would you describe that?
I would say every one of those people, Jim. Every from the president on down. The president in Afghanistan, I don't think got a lot of attention, but his cabinetry from the national level on down. And I work on the provincial level on a provincial government team, which would basically be, I would say, if you think of it as a state and the provincial governor as a governor, and then he had certain districts which were maybe mayors, or I would equate them to. But we provided some assistance, and what that assistance consisted of was everything that you can think of.
So would this be assistance in how to set up an economic system or a security system, or what type of assistance would be provided?
So we provide assistance, and I'll let me caveat too by saying that it's not just military members on the provincial reconstruction team, which is what I operate on. There are USAID personnel and Department of State, Department of Agriculture. So there's a multitude of civilian entities who assist us with their expertise in helping to establish rule of law, economic stability, infrastructure, good governance policies, public health, education, you name it, all that stuff.
And did you find that you would not only be working with the host nation and but a variety of non-governmental organizations or NGOs from around the country, or would they all be? Would you always be working with other U.S. citizens?
No, absolutely. I absolutely worked with the host nation government, and there were NGOs and IGOs that were based in Afghanistan, but because it had such a focus worldwide, we got people from everywhere. So I worked with the people of Afghanistan, people from Italy, France, all over the place.
And in that regards, does language skills become a bit of a requirement, I suppose, or certainly a helpful byproduct in the civil affairs area?
Absolutely. Our active duty brothers and sisters, they're required to pick up a language. On the reserve side, it's not so much now. We do we have areas of responsibility, and each battalion has a specified space that they're supposed to be proficient in, and that comes along with a language. So we do send people to places like Jeff had mentioned, over to the Presidio or even to Fort Bragg, and they'll learn a language. So language is, if you speak the language, you have given yourself more clout among the people you're speaking with, especially in Afghanistan.
And Jeff, let me turn to you. As you move from special forces into something like civil affairs, how did you find that transition? And again, how did the language proficiency that you developed factor in?
Well, Jim, it was really it's a direct transition. In fact, back in the early 2000s, the only active civil affairs NGOs were prior special forces MOSs. There was no way to go to a civil affairs MOS on active duty unless you were prior SF. So language back in the early 2000s was a requirement. Now that's obviously changed over the last bunch of years because there's such a huge need. But the operating portion, operating in the environment, pretty much operating independently, that's why the transition was so, I don't want to say simple, but it was a natural transition.
So let me develop that a little bit more. And again, Jeff, we're having a little bit of problems with your cell connection. So I'll throw this out to either John or you, Jeff, that you mentioned that the transition was somewhat easy in that in special forces you're really operating independently, and when you get over to civil affairs, you find yourself often in a small group and operating independently. Is that can you elaborate on that any, Jeff, and also John?
Sure. I've got a real simple example for you. When I first went to Kosovo, which was less than a year after 9/11, I ended up in a sector that was controlled by the Russians as a result of my Russian language. So I was a FOB commander, a FOB of about 25 of us, consisting of military intelligence, MPs, CA, PSYOP, and a human team. So we were pretty much off on our own. We had visits about once a week from the regular Army folks, from the battalion commander that kind of had that area as a minor sphere of influence. So that's typically how a CA team will work. They'll end up being on a CA team level. They'll be attached to a battalion. But they've got two chains of command. So their reporting side goes through that war fighting side of the house, that military battalion commander, the infantry or armor, whatever it ends up being. And then they've got the other chain of command, which flows to the civil affairs side. And that's the part that many civil affairs operators, as well as many people, you know, have a hard time figuring out. So oftentimes, CA teams will end up, let's say, floating. They're on their own. And back in the early 2000s, a lot of times making up things as they go, let's say.
Or using their best judgment, if you want to put it in a better spin, right?
Well, I'm saying making things up as they go because they do. They're much more mature, generally. Best judgment is a really good way to put it. You've got to make very educated decisions, sometimes in a very short span of time. And you mentioned earlier, working at that high government level, you're very often working at a level that's three or four ranks above your pay grade. So as a captain, I'm working at the Fulbert Colonel or General Officer level on a regular basis.
And John, did you similarly find that when involved in civil affairs matters, the team is acting more independently and has to rely a little more on those instincts associated with doing that?
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. We are given a broad concept of mission and allowed to pretty much go in a direction that we feel with some guidance on the team and some, some exterior guidance, et cetera, about which way to go to affect stuff that has a strategic impact oftentimes. We tend to be independent operators and things that we get into are anywhere from two to four personnel, typically. If you get on a bigger team, then you just happen to be luckier. But most of the time, it's two to four personnel. And we do operate a lot with military intelligence personnel, special forces and personnel. So the transition that Jeff is talking about probably was an easy one for him in that there is some independent operation allowed when you come to the civil affairs side of things.
Did both of you find that it took a certain type of personality to be, or personality traits, I suppose, to be successful in civil affairs?
Yeah, 100%. If you are not a people person, you don't have good operatory skills, you are not a researcher, et cetera, you are not going to do well.
You know, Jim, we found out early on in Operation Iraqi Freedom. Right now, I'd say we've got unbelievable civil affairs forces, but in the very beginning, we transitioned from a force that was a way to easily get promoted and travel to that first and second rotation. We figured out what the job was really about, so the type A personalities that are boisterous, that are able to easily communicate, they perform very well. Those that weren't, and they were referred to oftentimes as FOBs, individuals that would stay on the FOB even though their job should have been outside the FOB, the forward operating base, those individuals did not last. So civil affairs has made a great transition. They've got a solid force now that that really is unbelievable compared to where CA was 10, 12 years ago.
This has been very interesting, and we're going to come back and talk some more about civil affairs and the types of assignments that you might get right after words from one of our sponsors.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back on Veterans Radio on WAM 1600 Talk Radio out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. We're talking to Major Jeff Hoos and Master Sergeant John Archer, both with experience in civil affairs. Jeff, I'm kind of curious. John mentioned that a lot of the work with civilian leaders might be about infrastructure, and being one who was in combat engineering, and did you have the opportunity to tackle infrastructure assignments and use some of that experience as well?
Boy, did I ever. I was really surprised on my first tour in Iraq when I showed up. The brigade commander talked to the civil affairs teams within our sector, and it came down to a bottom line. At that time, it was all about how much money we can spend out in sector to influence the local population. So at a CA team level, an Army captain, I was pretty much in the free range. We had projects going on at $50,000. That was my cap. Over the course of 9 months, I had over $4 million worth of projects that were infrastructure projects. And that could have been something as simple as sewage treatment, garbage disposal, building schools, building clinics, building government structures, anything a local government would need. And that's what we ended up doing on the construction side of the house.
John, have you had similar experiences with infrastructure projects in your civil affairs role?
In my experience, the infrastructure side of what we do tends to drive a huge amount of the activity we do. And as Jeff said, that's where you run up most of your project money. So, like here, the idea is to shore up the infrastructure and get people working, and you do that by initiating projects like culvert denial systems to putting curbs on street or filling potholes, anything you can think of that you would term throw in the infrastructure category. So it could be quite a few things, as Jeff was just talking about.
Now, when you both of you guys enlisted, did you ever think you'd be running construction projects?
Never. No, I didn't even think I'd be a civil affairs guy. I was a very headstrong 18-year-old guy who just wanted to be an infantry guy, and thankfully I grew up since then.
Maybe you can talk about that a little, John, because I think that's you mentioned the maturity or growing up that it takes. How does this evolution occur?
Hopefully it occurs naturally in everyone. I can only speak for myself. I thought that I would affect the most change in the military by the use of my M4 or other violence of action, but it comes to my attention that you can get more done by picking up a pen and a paper as a civil affairs officer or NCO than you can by using the your weapon, and I believe that wholeheartedly, and I would caution people who are considering this MOS that if you think that you're going to deploy a bit, you might be correct, but what you need to understand is that you need to be able to affect change and diplomacy with your words and your actions other than weapon systems. So I was lucky enough to have spent time in the infantry and to have seen how that works and decide here in the past couple of years that I'd like to do this type of work, and I've enjoyed every single second of it, and I wish that I would have done it earlier, to be quite honest with you.
Well, that's how a lot of these things go in life, isn't it? We think it's going to be a straight line, and it gets pretty crooked over time, but you get to the right spot, and you're really happy you got there. Listeners, I'm talking to two gentlemen who have served our country for between the two of them something like 42 years. They both have Bronze Stars. One of them has received the Purple Heart. They both have, I believe, Iraq Campaign Medals. The list of awards goes on and on, to tell you the truth. But what I'm hearing, I think both of you say, and Jeff, maybe you want to talk about this, is that you found the civil affairs work to be real rewarding.
Absolutely. It really is rewarding. A really good way to put it that I tell people this all the time, it's kind of like a carrot and a stick mentality. Civil affairs is often the element that has a carrot. The maneuver battalions, the warfighters, have the stick. CA does have the stick, too, if they need to utilize that, but they prefer to utilize the carrots. If we can bring as many people as possible into our side, utilizing that carrot it's just so much simpler over time. We do go back and forth with both of them. We've got to be the maturity part of it that John was talking about. We've got to be able to fully understand what that warfighting function is doing and be able to integrate our operations into what they're doing in order to be effective. But when the warfighting commanders figure out what we bring to bear, they really do lean on us heavily, and oftentimes it turns out better. It might cost a taxpayer a few more dollars to go out and build a school or put a project together that employs a number of people. But by employing those individuals, we're taking more of those enemy forces out of the battlefield. The end run, it's better for us as far as a life-saving aspect, monetary aspect. I mean, you can look at every single way that we do this, and that's the way to really go.
Well, one of the things that the reason this caught my eye and I wanted to talk about it is the general news media spends all its time talking about drone strikes and what we blew up or what problem occurred, and things like what the military is out building through civil affairs, the relationships, the trust, doesn't get a lot of play. In the good old days, we'd call them humanitarian missions, which don't get a lot of play either on the theory that it has to bleed to lead on the news. So I think it's really helpful for the general public to hear from guys like you who are out there doing these projects, and maybe you can talk about how they're received by the indigenous population. John?
Hey, John, I can
sure.
Get this one real
in my
quick.
Experience, you know, I wasn't the first guy on the ground where I was, so the population was quite used to working with civil affairs guys. They tend to judge us by our actions, as far as I can tell. And if you are someone who professes to be there to help, and you show them that you're there to help through projects and et cetera, then the people are people everywhere, and they tend to respond well. If you show up and you've got other more nefarious ideas, then I expect that people, no matter where they are, will react appropriately also.
Jeff, do you want to comment on that as well?
Yeah, we utilize what we call measures of effectiveness. And that's the hard part. You know, how do you measure how effective what you're doing really is on the battlefield?
John, you're breaking up again. I need you to center that cell phone.
Okay, you got me now?
That's it, yes.
Okay. I would carry children... pictures of my children with me. That's the one international thing that people all hold near and dear to their heart, and explain to them, hey, I'm not here necessarily for me or for you. I'm here for my children. I'm here for their future. What are you doing about your children's future? Things like that really, really work well in the majority of cultures around the world. So when we can get a common language, get away from the war-fighting language, it's much easier to get somebody going the direction you want to. And when they don't, we just turn right over to those other resources we have available to us, whether it's an intel team or a PSYOP team, and say, hey, this guy's not somebody that necessarily wants to talk to me. Maybe you should talk to him.
So we're down to the last few minutes. Believe it or not, the hour's gone that fast. I told you it would. And I wanted to ask both of you a little bit about what you're doing now. John, I'll start with you if you can talk about your upcoming deployment and the Center for Army Lessons Learned that you're involved with.
Sure. I got notified I was going to go, and I was supposed to have been gone now, as a matter of fact, but that's imminent. The Center for Army Lessons Learned is an entity that does collection and analysis, dissemination, recording of like tactics and techniques, procedures that the military uses, and we record the solutions so that the Army has the advantage of remembering what worked and what didn't, as a matter of fact. And that goes from the tactical level all the way up to the street theater and the strategic level types of procedures that were there to do. So basically, I will embed within the unit, go to where I'm going, and pick up the best practices for the Army to use against whomever it is that I am tasked to be gathering information from.
Well,
that's not cryptic enough.
No, we understand and we appreciate that. We wish you Godspeed and safe return. We're down to the final minute. Jeff, why don't you mention what you're doing now?
Yeah, real quick. I'm teaching ROTC at Western Michigan University, molding the minds of our future leaders. We've got some big individuals coming up. We'll be joining the ranks very soon here. And really look forward to seeing what they're going to bring to the table over the next 20, 30 years or so.
Well, we really appreciate that. We appreciate you being on Veterans Radio. We appreciate Rally Point, one of our program friends, helping find Master Sergeant John Archer before he got deployed. We learned a lot. We appreciate both of you gentlemen sharing this with us. Your military careers have been quite distinguished, and I know you're going to continue to do great work, whether it's out in the field or shaping the minds of military members to come for future generations. This has been very informational for all of us. We ask those of you who are listening to Veterans Radio to like us on Facebook. That way you'll be able to track the upcoming shows that we have. Go to our website, veteransradio.net, and continue to participate in the program. We wish you all a great fall, and thank you for listening to Veterans Radio. You are dismissed.